Hello everybody, welcome to the Global Strategy Forum Fringe meeting. I'm delighted to see so many of you here. As you know, Global Strategy Forum was set up as a think tank about 18 months ago, and the idea of the forum is to try and generate discussion and debate by having people to come and speak or to write articles who will generate discussion and debate by speaking in a forthright manner and saying what they think. And over the last 18 months, I think we've built rather a good reputation for ourselves of having people who whose speeches are remembered for some time afterwards. And what we wanted to do today was to carry on with that here at the conference. We have no agenda ourselves as a think tank except to provide that forum. And we're very lucky today, and I'm delighted that he's here, that we have somebody who is known for speaking his mind. All the time I've known him over the last 4 years, he's never failed to say what he thinks at the right moment, and it's very refreshing to hear him. And I'm delighted to be able to introduce to you today Ambassador John Bolton. And I'm going to say a word or two about him because he has had a significant career over these last years. He was the United States representative to the United Nations from August 2005 to December 2006. And during his time there, he was a great and outspoken advocate of US efforts to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. He fought hard to get Syria out of Lebanon and to bring African peacekeepers into Somalia. He pushed a sanction resolution through the United Nations Security Council after North Korea's nuclear test, and he formed the resolution to end Hezbollah's 2006 attack on Israel. Mr. Bolton was also an advocate of human rights, arranging the Security Council's first deliberations on Burma's human rights abuses, which is very topical as we know today. He invited George Clooney, among others, to brief the Security Council on what was happening in Darfur in Sudan, and later sent 22,500 United Nations peacekeepers to that region. Prior to his time at the United Nations, he served 4 years as Under Secretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, and that was where I first met him when I was the Shadow Foreign Secretary. And again, in that role too, he never failed to say what he thought. And I think in politics, it's great when you do get people who are prepared to say what they think, even if you have a good argument about it afterwards. I can even give you better news. He's got a book coming out fairly shortly called Surrender is Not an Option, Defending America at the United Nations and Abroad. It's going to be released in November, and I hope that we will all wait with anticipation the release of that book. But I have great delight in asking him to address us now. Ambassador John Bolton.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, and I'm delighted to be here today, delighted to be here at my first Conservative Party conference and to address the Global Strategy Forum. And I want to thank Michael and Jonathan for the invitation. This is really quite something to see this. It's a little bit different from our quadrennial conventions, but it's a lot of fun, I can see already, and obviously at a very important time in politics in the United Kingdom. I don't really want to get into the specifics of your own internal politics here, but I do. I suppose I will inevitably, but I want to talk to you about some of the things that are of concern to us in the United States. We at least have the advantage, if you will, of knowing we have a presidential election next year. We're already deeply into our campaign for the nominations of the Democratic and Republican parties. And obviously, in a general election here, a presidential election in the United States, inevitably there are important domestic, economic, and social issues that the candidates have to confront. But the point that I make in the United States, and I would just say respectfully it's true here as well, is this is a time of great challenge for the United States and the United Kingdom in the international sphere. That the threats that we face from the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and from international terrorism are not getting any less. They're growing more acute. And I will say, with all due respect to all of our friends in Europe, there is too much of a view in Europe that you have passed beyond history, and that there are no more threats, that the way you deal with potential problems in the world, whether it's in the Security Council in New York or elsewhere, is the same way you deal with problems in Brussels, that everything can be worked out by negotiation, that inevitably there is some solution that will leave everybody happy, and that everybody shares the same values, the same approaches, the same spirit of compromise and willingness to try and see through to a political solution. That is a view too widespread in Europe, hopefully not in this party, but too widespread in Europe as a whole. And I can tell you that Democrat or Republican, by and large in the first instance, but Democrat or Republican, we don't see it that way. The world is still full of challenges, and challenges that international institutions are not particularly adept at handling. I'd like to talk particularly today about the threats of weapons of mass destruction and how those threats need to be addressed, because whether in the hands of rogue states like North Korea or Iran, or God forbid that weapons would be transferred to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, these weapons pose a threat not in the existential sense that we saw in the Cold War and a possible nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, but in the sense that these are not military weapons. These are weapons that are primarily intended to threaten innocent civilian populations. And in that sense, they are terrorists, whether they are wielded by terrorist groups or by rogue states. And we see the consequences of the inability of international institutions like the Security Council to address these threats seriously. And I want to take you through some of the logic of this and some of the consequences, because it is why, for the United States, our decision in 2008 on a presidential candidate is going to be so important, and why, if there is an election here in the United Kingdom, that the decision that your fellow voters will make will be intensely important for the United States as well as for you. The fact is that with the end of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet Union, the threat of weapons of mass destruction, whether nuclear, chemical, or biological, did not go away. Indeed, freed from the restraints of the Cold War, I think the threat of proliferation has grown even greater. And we have now two case studies in the form of North Korea and Iran that are intensely important not only in their own right, but for the lessons that others will draw depending on how the North Korean and Iranian threats are resolved. If North Korea retains its nuclear weapons capability, and if Iran achieves a nuclear weapons capability, other countries in their regions and around the world will draw the appropriate conclusion, and that is that it's entirely possible to succeed despite any commitments they may or may not have made under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, let's take North Korea, where you've heard since earlier this year there's been good news, some people believe, because of the February agreement in the six-party talks, and apparent progress being made next week. The president of South Korea will journey to Pyongyang to meet with Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader. They will declare, I predict, peace on the Korean Peninsula, sweetness and light breaking out, and all problems solved. Unfortunately, the reality is much different. And in large part, it stems from the very nature of the North Korean regime. It is essentially the most authoritarian government on the planet today. It is basically a large prison camp. The 18 to 20 million North Koreans have a standard of living that can only be described as horrible over the past several decades. This is a truly frightening statistic. The height and weight, the average height and weight of the North Korean population has been declining. Just think about that. They're growing shorter and thinner. All the while, the regime takes in revenue, perpetuating itself in power, living in a grand style, and aggressively pursuing weapons of mass destruction. The North Korean government is essentially criminal. It will sell anything to anybody for hard currency. It's the world's largest proliferator of ballistic missile technology, especially into the sensitive Middle East. It sells illegal narcotics through its diplomatic pouches. Until recently, it's run organized crime in Japan. It counterfeits at least American money that we know of so successfully that our Treasury Department refers to their counterfeit notes as super bills. So expert are they that we can't even really estimate how much they've put in circulation. This is a regime that, despite all of its disadvantages, we now know has a nuclear weapons capability because they tested it in October. They have committed in the course of the negotiations this year to give up that nuclear capability, thus causing some people to think that we had made a breakthrough. The only difficulty is North Korea is perfectly happy to negotiate giving up its nuclear weapons. It's even happy to commit to give up its nuclear weapons. It's done it several times in the past decade. It's very happy to do that, especially in exchange for tangible economic and political benefits. The only problem is that when push comes to shove, North Korea is not voluntarily going to give up its nuclear weapons. It sees the nuclear capability as a trump card against the United States, against Japan, South Korea, and it's not going to be talked out of these weapons voluntarily. It will do what it takes to deceive those that are subject to deception, trying to extract these tangible benefits while retaining its nuclear capability. And we have at least some indication that their willingness to engage in camouflage and deception extends to potential nuclear cooperation with Syria. No better way than to conceal your nuclear program than to get it out of Dodge and put it in some other place where the inspectors are not looking. The question of North Korea is not simply a threat in Northeast Asia, although it certainly is a threat there. It is a threat globally because of the North Korean regime's propensity to sell to anybody who can pay for it. I think the long-term solution to the North Korean nuclear weapons problem will only come with the achievement of reunification of the Korean Peninsula. It's been the goal of the United States and indeed the Allied countries of World War II since 1945 that the peninsula be reunited. This can be accomplished if China were to get serious about eliminating the North Korean nuclear threat. China says it doesn't want a North Korea with nuclear weapons. I take them at their word for that, since I think a nuclear North Korea could lead Japan or South Korea or Taiwan to consider nuclear weapons on their own, and that kind of proliferation in Northeast Asia cannot be beneficial to China. But China is not willing, has not been willing, to apply sufficient pressure to Kim Jong-il to achieve that result. And the reason is because China fears that if it applies too much pressure to this essentially fragile regime, that the regime will collapse. And if that happens, there will be reunification on the Korean Peninsula because South Korean and American forces will move in to prevent a situation of anarchy and loss of control of the nuclear weapons. China fears a reunited Korea, in part because it fears American troops based as far north as the Yalu River. It saw that movie once before. It didn't like it in 1950. It doesn't like it any better today. So the consequence is that China doesn't do what uniquely China can do, cut off North Korea's energy supply. China supplies 90% of North Korea's fuel oil. China could solve the North Korean nuclear weapons program, but it's currently not inclined to do so. And that is why the position that China takes, not just in North Korea, but in a range of other issues around the world, in Burma, as Michael said, in the Sudan, where one wonders why China defends the regime there against inserting UN peacekeepers into the Darfur region. It's because of China's concern for oil and natural gas, its large and growing energy demand. And that's an explanation of why China takes the protective position it does in the UN Security Council when it comes to Iran. Now, Iran is a country that for nearly 20 years has been pursuing its own clandestine effort to acquire nuclear weapons. It has lied to the International Atomic Energy Agency. It has concealed data from the IAEA. It's gone so far as to destroy buildings and bulldoze hundreds of cubic yards of dirt in an effort to avoid having the IAEA inspectors detect traces of radioactivity. Iran says, well, this program is purely peaceful. It's purely to give us an alternative source of energy because our oil and natural gas is running out. I asked the U.S. Department of Energy some years back to look into this Iranian claim about the exhaustion of their oil and natural gas resources, and the Energy Department did its calculations and came back and said, well, you know, actually, Iran is right. They are running out of oil and natural gas. At their present rates of domestic consumption and export, Iran will run out of oil and natural gas in roughly 350 or 400 years, which of course explains for any reasonable person why you need a civil nuclear program. The fact is, we know that the Iranian program simply cannot be explained except as an effort to acquire nuclear weapons and deliverable missile systems. And here, the conjunction of North Korea and Iran becomes important, because President Bush's famous reference to the axis of evil was more than metaphoric. We know that North Korea and Iran and Syria have cooperated extensively over the years on their ballistic missile program. In the late 1990s, North Korea declared a moratorium on launch testing from the Korean Peninsula of ballistic missiles after it landed a Taipodong in the Pacific east of Japan, which got their attention in Tokyo, I can tell you that. North Korea declared a moratorium. It won a big propaganda victory for apparent restraint. And then it immediately turned to Iran to engage in joint research on ballistic missiles, which made entirely good sense since the technology they were both using was from Scud missiles of the Soviet era. This conjunction of efforts is yet another reason why the resolution of the Iranian and North Korean problems will be watched so carefully in many capitals. And here, I regret to say, in the case of Iran, we have seen a failure of the West as a whole, but I will say it with all due respect, particularly a European failure, and I think a failure of the government of the United Kingdom. For over 4 years, going on five now, what we at least in Washington call the EU3, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, have been pursuing negotiations with Iran in an effort to talk the Iranians out of their nuclear ambitions. And they have offered incentive after incentive, carrots, as we say in the diplomatic lexicon, carrots rather than sticks, carrots to Iran as inducement to give up particularly their uranium enrichment activities. And for over 4 years, the EU3 have offered more carrots than you can imagine, more caravans of carrot trucks on the way to Tehran, which the Iranians have consistently refused to accept. They have said for four straight years, we will never give up our uranium enrichment efforts. We have a right to it, and we intend to continue it. Now, the United States is fully complicit in this because we acquiesced in these European Union negotiations, which continue even to this day, with Javier Solana again offered up to negotiate with the Iranians. And what has the consequence been of four-plus years of negotiation? It has given Iran the one asset it could not purchase, the one asset that no amount of money could have gotten them, and that's time. Time is not on our side when it comes to the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Time is what gives the proliferators the ability to do as Iran has done and perfect the complex scientific and technological steps that need to be taken to give them complete domestic mastery over the nuclear fuel cycle. Iran now has that. And when you combine that with their very aggressive support for terrorism in their region in particular, the efforts they have made in Iraq to kill our soldiers and your soldiers by training, by the supply of weapons, by finance, to Shiite radicals, and quite possibly even to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, despite the religious differences. They supply the Taliban, once their sworn enemy in Afghanistan, with similar resources to fight the NATO troops there. They supply Hezbollah in Lebanon to the tune of at least $100 million a year, and they finance Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Iran is pushing out, and it's not receiving adequate pushback. I'm afraid that the consequences of four-plus years of failed diplomacy and the advantage that Iran has received limit our options for dealing with them, indeed constrain them very significantly to two: regime change in Tehran, We're hopefully following the pattern of South Africa. If there were a new democratic government that could conclude that it was not in their best interest to pursue nuclear weapons, that might be a solution, but that could take time. And that's why, although it's an unattractive option at best, because life is about choices, I think we need to consider the use of military force. That's not attractive. It has a lot of risks. But if the choice is between an Iran with nuclear weapons and the use of military force to prevent that and to prevent the consequences in the region, I think we have to look at a limited strike against their nuclear facilities. Now, obviously, both the case of North Korea and Iran immediately raise the question, but what about Iraq? What about Iraq? And I am here to tell you that 4 years plus after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, it still strikes me as absolutely the correct thing to have done to remove Saddam Hussein from power. His regime was a threat to international peace and security. His effort to acquire weapons of mass destruction, not imminent, as we know clearly now, but had never disappeared. Even those who say, well, my goodness, the IAEA said that they found no physical evidence of a nuclear weapons program in Iraq before the war, that's exactly correct. But what Saddam had was 1,000 scientists and technicians, whom he called his nuclear mujahideen, the people with the intellectual capability of recreating the nuclear program that he would have put back into operation once free of UN sanctions and inspectors. The lesson of Iraq is that striking against a regime that's determined to have weapons of mass destruction can be successful. And the strategic objective, the main strategic objective of eliminating the threat posed by Saddam's regime was achieved. There's no doubt that the 4 years since then have not been happy. We've learned a lot of lessons, but that period does not undercut the fundamental wisdom of making sure that rogue regimes and terrorist groups don't get weapons of mass destruction in the first place. It is not enough to say that we can retaliate after a nuclear weapon has been used. And it's not enough to say that we can count on deterrence the same way we did in the Cold War. In fact, we were lucky during the Cold War. There are any number of cases where we were extremely close to nuclear war. And it was only because the calculations of the Soviet Union and ours happened to be happily based on the same assumptions that we were able to avoid it. I don't think we can count on that rationality, if you can use that word in the nuclear context. We can't count on that level of rationality from Kim Jong-il, whose closest equivalent I think is Hitler in the bunker in the waning days of World War II, or President Ahmadinejad of Iran, whose idea of happiness is in the afterlife, not in this life. This is not a situation where retaliation is ever going to be sufficient. Now, it's not an exchange, as I said before, like it might have been with the Soviet Union, but what would an American politician say, or what would a British politician say, if a rogue state or a terrorist group successfully ignited even one nuclear weapon? What are you going to say? Well, it was only Manchester. It is unacceptable to live under threat by madmen and rogue states and terrorists with these weapons of enormous destructive ability, which is why we have said and why I continue to believe that if other means fail, the preemptive use of force has to be considered to deny these terrorist and rogue state dictators the weapons in the first place, because responding after they're used is simply not sufficient. That is a lesson I think we need to debate in our presidential election, and with respect, perhaps in your election too, if one's coming. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I'd be happy to answer questions really on whatever is on your mind. I didn't address the UN so much with respect to these issues because I think the UN is fundamentally irrelevant to these issues, but I'd be I'd be delighted to answer any other questions about the UN you might have.